What's happening, people, and welcome to this month's episode of the Football Fans Podcast, The Shootout. You know how we do by now in The Shootout. We invite a pro or a former pro to come on the show and dig a little bit deeper into their career. We get a little bit more up close and personal, but this week on the pod, we're doing it with a bit of a twist because we also have a couple of our regulars on the pod this week with our guest. Before I get to those two, I want to introduce our special guest on the FFP Shootout for this month. First class law degree, first woman to feature on Match of the Day, two spells at Birmingham, two spells at Chelsea, Charlton, a spell in the USA, and also a spell at Juventus. 102 caps for England with 33 goals to boot. Three World Cups, three Euros, and also an appearance, five appearances, should I say, at the 2012 Olympic Games as part of Team GB. Can we get some love in the studio, please, for Eni Aluko, please? Hey. Eni, how are you doing?
I feel good. I'm good, thank you. That was a very nice introduction.
Come on, we've got to hype you. We've got to show the love, you know.
You should wait till you hear ours, Eni. It's not going to
be like that. Oh, yeah, G0 as well.
Come on.
Are you well, though?
I feel really good, yes. It's good to be back home. It's good to be back in London. Enjoying life, looking forward to Christmas. Yeah.
Good. Well, really glad to have you on the show today. Like I said, we don't normally have guests.
With our
main guests. But let's make it a bit more inclusive and let's make it a bit more debatey today. We've got so many things I want to get through with you today. And I know we've not got you for too long. So we'll try and get through as much as we can. And for Duma and G, please. Are you guys alright, by the way?
Yeah.
Because I do kind of care how you guys are, and just out of basic manners.
Well, no, Joel, I'm not okay.
Okay.
Oh. We'll get to that.
Let's just move on anyway. And you guys, you know, jump in when you want. Let's go backwards first, Eni. Your last spell was at Juventus.
Yes.
Talk us through how that came about and your experience in Italy and what were the main things that you kind of learned from? I know you had a spell in America as well, but what were the main things that you learned from being a footballer in a different country, in a different league?
Well, how it came about really was after sort of 6 years at Chelsea, the last sort of 3 years were a very successful period. So won, I believe, 5 titles in 4 years at Chelsea. And I hit 30, and you know, obviously in football, that's sort of what's going to happen now? And it was sort of a crossroads for me at Chelsea. It was like, oh, do you want to become a sort of squad player? You know, we were doing really well in the Champions League, and you know, Emma Hayes was bringing in new players, or do I want to go and sort of have a last swan song somewhere? And have a new experience. So it was a really difficult decision because Chelsea is very much my home. Mm-hmm. It's a club that I still support. But I decided I wanted to go and play in Europe. I hadn't done that before. And learn a new language and travel and all the things that I love to do anyway. And Juventus had come in for me the year before and I turned them down. And then I thought, right, okay, this is the time to do something different for a big club. Mm-hmm. With a big project. So yeah, I went over there, and to be honest, I didn't put too much pressure on myself. I wanted to kind of just be humble about it and let the experience dictate itself, and you know, play as well as I could. I knew I was going to play because they needed me. They needed a forward, so I knew that. I mean, it turned out really successful season. Mm. I finished the top scorer with 16 goals, mm-hmm. won the league, won the Coppa Italia, played at the Allianz Stadium, sold out stadium. So it was very, very successful first year. And then it was kind of like unfinished business because we didn't do that well in the Champions League. And so I came back for another year, played in the Champions League again, got knocked out by Barcelona, which probably was expected. And then we won the equivalent of sort of the League Cup here, so it's called the Super Coppa. Mm-hmm. And when I won that, I was a bit like, okay, what more can I do?
What's next?
And it was around the time I'd just released my book, so there was lots going on back home, and it was kind of like, again, it was like, okay, what am I here for? You know, if the objective in the Champions League is not really, we're not getting any closer to it, what more can I do here away from my family and friends? So it was a really, really difficult decision to leave sort of 6 months early, but I felt that it was the right time to do that.
And having played for, you know, Juventus women's team, is it women's or ladies? They
women.
Women. You know, in amongst a club that is a giant of a club in world football anyway, what was it like? How did they treat the women's team alongside the men's team in comparison to working and playing for Chelsea, a kind of big team, and having them as well?
How dare you?
Was there a massive difference in approach to how Juventus treated their women's team to how big teams in England treat their women's team?
Not really. I mean, there's investment there, and you know, the women's team for Juventus is very much treated with the same level of professionalism as the men. And actually, the Italian women's league only just turned professional, I think, 2 days ago. So it was very professional setup. The training ground we were at was the old men's training ground, which was excellent. Mm-hmm. We had full access to an amazing gym. There was lots of many professional things. You know, the players, we had 9 Italian international players in the team. You know, we had a big staff group.
Was there much crossover with the men's and women's team?
A little bit more so from the media side.
Okay.
I did all of the Adidas campaigns for the shirts, for example. So you see me right next to Ronaldo and Dybala and
which is
cool. Like, that's, you know, that's the stuff that you need to be seeing and normalizing, you know, women's football. Mm-hmm. That's how it happens. You know, when a young boy goes into the club shop to buy a shirt and sees me next to Ronaldo, he's like, who's that? I want to go watch, you know. So mm-hmm. that's how it kind of subconsciously. So I was really impressed with those elements. And there's lots of elements of Italian football that I thought are the best I've ever experienced. So, for example, nutrition. It's probably the fittest I've ever felt in my career.
Okay.
Sports science was very good. I just felt that culturally it was a little bit of a culture shock.
Just on that point now, that's interesting, because I don't know if we mentioned it a couple of weeks ago on the pod, G, but Lukaku, when he was at Manchester United, had a lot of criticism about his size and his weight and being able to keep the weight off. Mm. And then he goes to Inter Milan, and the club doctor there, I believe, did something that worked out that he was eating something that in that thing made him bulkier than he was.
Yeah.
Is the level of sports science and nutrition in Italy significantly better?
Significantly. Maybe it's not better, but they're just more specific about stuff. So okay. It's very detailed. So every day I knew exactly what I should be eating at exactly the right time. You know, a lot of the food is locally sourced. So you might be eating the same type of food that you eat in England, like pasta, but it's just fresher and more healthy.
Okay.
You know, the training was high intensity. So, you know, you're training at a sort of maximum all the time.
In a way that at Chelsea it wasn't.
No, it's not.
That wasn't a shot.
It's not really that. I mean, there's so many different ways of skinning the cat in football. You know, you can be successful in so many different ways. Mm. It's just that the Italian way is very, very focused on fitness.
Okay.
And nutrition, and it benefited my body, mm-hmm. And so I felt I didn't really have any injuries at all, really, during the 18-month period I was there. So that's an element that I really big up, because it, you know, those are the things that you learn about different cultures.
Yeah. And Maldini and Totti were playing to like 64.
That's why.
And Fadima, you were out in France for the World Cup. So how did you find the attitude of the French public and international markets that came to France to watch the World Cup? How did you find their approach to with the women's game in relation, or in comparison, should I say, to how we view, treat and show women's football in this country?
I think it's quite hard to use the World Cup as a comparison, just because I didn't see any of like the French league over there. But during the World Cup period, it was... In the lead up to that, I spent a lot of time here, and I spent a lot of time working different media and teams promoting the World Cup. So to me, I just thought it was going to be this massive show and there was going to be thousands and millions of people watching it. But when I got to Nice and when I got to Paris, it was locally, there wasn't much there to promote the World Cup as such. It was a case of, unless you were going to the stadium to go and watch a game, or you were at a fan zone, you wouldn't really know there was a World Cup going on. So I guess from a marketing point of view, it didn't really go up to the standards that a lot of us thought it would in the UK. And if you just look at the numbers, like, for example, the England versus Scotland game, there was about 20,000 fans there. Majority of them were English and Scottish fans. There was very little like local fans that came out to watch the game, despite the fact that the stadiums were very easily accessible to people that lived in Nice, for example. So I guess in that sense, it seemed like there wasn't a lot of support and on a local level to it. But similarly, like certain games, there was a lot more support. So, for example, like in Paris, there was all the numbers that it was like thousands and thousands of people. I remember 40,000 on the opening game. Mm-hmm. But then you'd expect that because Paris is the largest city.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, a lot of the other stadiums just didn't get that support. And I guess it was just that locally it wasn't as focused on as you would have thought coming into the World Cup from your like supporting country.
What did you make any of the World Cup this summer? Did you enjoy it? Was a standard as to the level that you expected it to, or did it exceed that?
I really enjoyed it. I was there with Fox for a month. Mm-hmm. We're working for the TV in a nice 6-star hotel in Shangri-La.
6-star, you know, it is them bars, geez. 6 stars.
That was not my
boy.
I can't complain. But I think in terms of the level of competition, you saw that it's raised. I mean, there was 8 European teams in the last 8, and then USA pretty much versus Europe. So it told a story that, you know, the levels of investment now across European leagues are really, really mean that European national teams are doing very well.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed, obviously, all the coverage. You know, we were breaking viewing figures in terms of BBC, in terms of, you know, international viewing figures. But as Fadouma said, you know, I think what a lot of people don't talk about is that there weren't sellout crowds mm-hmm. in France.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a disappointment, because what you've got is groundbreaking viewing figures, but
it's not translating.
It's still not translating. And it is, as you said, it is in Paris and big cities. Mm. But what we want is women's football to be an attended sport, not just a sport that people watch every four years.
Sure, yeah.
So that's where I still thought we could do, like, the game needs to do more in terms of transferring all of that attention and energy into weekly habits of supporting your team every week to watch those players in the World Cup.
I hear that. So one person that wasn't watching the Women's World Cup was you, Jay.
Well, hold on a minute.
You wasn't watching the World Cup.
Because,
I did watch the Women's World Cup. Partially, but I don't watch women's football.
You're not a massive lover of the women's game.
Yeah. Why is that?
That was my next question.
Honestly, I just don't think the quality is as high as the men's football. There's elements of men's football that I don't watch either. So it's not it's very easy to look at it and think, oh, that's just a sexist attitude. It's just about the level of attention.
Quality.
Yeah, I think the main thing that I would say that...
But let me just intervene on that argument, because I hear that argument such a lot, but I just don't... I think it's bizarre to think like that, because if you look at women's football, it's a sport that was banned for a period of 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're watching, for example, the WSL, which is the highest level of women's football there is in this country, and mm-hmm. it is a competitive league. But it's also kind of just like saying... we're only going to watch football if it's... Like, you would have watched football 50 years back in the men's football, and it probably would have been to the same level that it is right now, but it is at its highest, as it can, at its...
That's
current,
a fair point.
That's
true. Let me counter it and maybe give the examples. I think the goalkeeping sometimes in the women's game, I look at a lot of shots and I think that wasn't right in the corner or you know... top quality goalkeeper would save that. Now, to be fair, Kepa has proven that that's not always the case as well. But I look at that, and I guess, you know, like whenever I watch, because sometimes it comes on after match of the day. So there's sometimes that, you know, like, you know, you get lazy. End up watching it. But I always seem to see like a horrendous blunder. Or like, I remember watching the other week and I saw...
Didn't you see Arsenal, like, my team, play on the weekend?
This is my point, that I think that, you know, and look, your taste is your taste. As you said, sometimes you don't watch certain men's football, and you know, as we say in Nigeria, it's not by force. But at the same time, I think there are preconditioned attitudes towards the women's game, which mean that you're harsher when mistakes are made.
That could be true.
So if a goalkeeper makes a mistake in the women's game, that means you're not going to watch women's football again. if a goalkeeper makes a mistake in the men's game, you're like, oh, that was rubbish, but I'm still waiting to see the next four games. Mm. Do you get what I mean? So I think the level of judgment is just so much higher, and I don't understand why that is, because that mistake can be quite easily balanced out by an amazing goal from one of the best players in the women's game.
What would you need
to
see in the women's game to make you... You said you mentioned the word quality.
Yeah.
Would it be that? And you mentioned goalkeeping. If the level of goalkeeping rose in the women's game, would that get you on board? Because I'm someone that I work to some degree in women's football. I watch a little bit of women's football. I'm not going to lie and sit here and say that I watch every single women's football game and I love it, because that would be a lie. But I don't not like it in a way that I don't think you don't like it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the quality, but then I think also... you have to have individuals you get a connection with, and like a club you get a connection with. Because don't get me wrong, watching Chelsea every week is not always quality, right?
But that is true.
But it is a... Oh,
United fan.
But I think there would have to be people of you know in the women's game that I could relate to that would draw me back to watch every week. And there are some good players. You know, I think Marta's really good. I actually liked really watching Ueni as well. I'm not just saying that because you're here.
This is awkward.
Okay, gonna win it back. Gonna win it back.
Imagine if you thought I was rubbish.
Listen, I reckon you should just watch it for the sake that this is probably women's like Chelsea team. It's probably your only chance of a cup.
Wow.
Wait, are you a Chelsea fan?
Oh,
yeah,
Chelsea,
he is.
Yeah.
Our women's team is sick.
That's what I mean.
Like, team is really
Frank
good.
Lampard isn't quite doing it at the minute, so you might as
our
well.
Our women's team is too.
Yeah, but that's
even
the thing.
A snob G.
Like, no, but
and Sam Kerr's coming, so like. That's
but when
top
I see
quality.
Frank Kirby will hit one into the top, into not quite the top corner, man. Yeah. It's not quite the top corner. It doesn't feel the same as...
All right.
Gee, I'm taking Hazard. You know, I'm taking you to a game.
I'm going
to
let you off the ropes
for a
minute.
It's not by force. There's lots of people that watch.
I'm going to let you off the ropes for a minute, G. I've just heard myself really bunged up, and I've had my malaria tablets today as well. So if my arm starts going a bit randomly weird in a second, it's because my tablets are kicking in. Serie A, today, announced their campaign, an anti-racism campaign. That if you've seen it, and it's got a lot of criticism because they're saying that the campaign is actually racist in itself.
What, with the monkeys?
Yes.
Yeah, I just...
What were your thoughts on that?
I mean, I don't know who these leagues consult with in terms of when they make a decision to do these campaigns. I don't know who the creative agencies are or the agencies that design these campaigns, but... It's just an own goal. Like, it just seems like they're making a lot of own goals every time. And I think the fundamental reason that is because at the heart of it, I'm not sure how much they actually care. Now, I've not sat in a room with any of the owners of the Serie A, so I don't want to make assumptions. But, like, when you look at the responses to genuine issues and genuine complaints in the Serie A, it's very defensive. It's very like, well, you know, this is part of the way we operate. Certainly from the fans, and the owners then defend the fans. So if you're doing a campaign, you're really just doing it because you need to do it. And you recognise that globally, Italy is a laughingstock when it comes to modern day football and racism in modern day football. Players like Lukaku are, and Chris Smalling are openly saying... this is stupid, like that Black Friday campaign, it's just dumb.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason why it doesn't translate, to all best intentions, it doesn't translate is because people can see that this is just a tick box.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? And I feel the same about some campaigns in England. Mm-hmm. It's not enough to just change your Twitter account to something that says, you know, what we need to be doing is sitting in rooms with decision makers, players, managers, sitting in rooms with decision makers and saying, listen, this is the impact of what's happening. If this isn't going to change, then we're going to start having collective action. That's where things really start to shift, because... And the media too have a responsibility, because, you know, media just want to keep talking about racism without actually doing anything about it. you need to hold these people to account. Mm-hmm. Go and do an interview or a feature or an investigative feature with some of these clubs and call, hold them to account. I think that's the issue. Like, there's a lot of these tick boxing kind of designer campaigns that look good and feel good, but actually underneath it, you're really just, you know, for want of a better word, spraying perfume over turd. Like, it's still, I don't know if I can swear on here, but it's still shit underneath.
No,
it's just not. There's no substance to it.
Can I ask? Because I think, because in it's fair to say it's, the perception anyway is that in women's football, the hooliganism element in the UK is a lot lower and it's a lot more family friendly environment. Is that the same in Italy, or did you experience?
Yeah. It's the same. Yeah, it's the same. I didn't experience any racism whatsoever, actually, on the football side, from the football pitch. And fans were very, very good with me. Even when I left, they were like, oh my God, we're going to miss you. And it was very, very warm. And but I think that's women's football in general. You're not getting that element of society coming in and supporting the women's team, because ultimately that element of society, those kind of ultras, ignorant, loud, obnoxious, they probably don't have that much respect for women anyway. Mm-hmm. So you're not getting that. But certainly in the men's game, I was very aware that it was like really, really bad.
Just a couple more quick ones on Italy, then we will move on. I lived in Italy for 4 years playing basketball, and I want to get your perspective on this. When I was in Italy, people asked me when I got back, oh, what was it like? Did you get racially abused? Da, 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 da. I was the only black player on my team, I think. Yeah. I didn't get any racial abuse, but what I did get was lots of looks from people in the town where I lived. And it wasn't looks of disgust or looks of like, get out of our town. It was more looks of,
what are you doing
here?
Yeah, I got
it. Do you know what I mean? That wasn't what you're clearly from America or the UK.
I got the same.
Why are you here?
Yeah. There's a balance between curiosity, ignorance, and just genuine, like inquisitiveness. Like.
Yeah.
But you see, that question of why are you here speaks to the lack of diversity that I found quite difficult. You take things, when you live in London, you take things for granted. You know, in the sense that you see people from all over the world. You're not asking them why are you here, because it's a multicultural melting pot. In Italy, or certainly in Turin, where I was, that question, why are you here, was a daily question. And I didn't see other black people like me anywhere. Like, forget sport. Like, even just in sort of managerial positions in shops, like, I just didn't see them. And so that why you hear question was just kind of poignant for me, because it was like, well, of course you're going to ask that, because you don't see anyone like
it's
me.
It's weird to you.
And I think in 2019, in one of the biggest cities in Italy, I found that quite disturbing. And so I found myself kind of uber defensive when that question was asked, even when it was asked innocently. Because it's like, well, I'm here to play football. I'm here, you know, I play for Juventus. And that was always quite a nice conversation. But then I started thinking, well, if I wasn't here playing for Juventus,
why can't you just be in Italy because you like the country?
Like, how would you treat me? And that's what I always think the racism kicks in. It's like, well, you know, you shouldn't have to qualify your race. I felt like I was always qualifying myself, like, oh, like in airports. I mean, I've spoken about this publicly in newspaper features I've done. Like, the last four weeks of my time in Italy, and actually I'd already decided I was leaving anyway. It was like, you know, every time I came into the airport, it was that, well, why are you here? Why are you coming through the airport? And then sniffer dogs were sniffing me, and it was, you know, and it just becomes a constant sort of qualification all the time. Well, I'm here for Juventus. I'm qualified to be here. Mm-hmm. That shouldn't mm-hmm. be the experience. So I just think there's a lack of diversity. And where there are black people, you see your extreme poverty and crime. And that's sad.
I saw that in Rome a lot as well. And final question on this topic. I talk a lot, I have done on previous pods, about the frustration that black male players going to places like Russia and Italy to play football. I question that because we all know what it's like in Russia for black people. We know what it's like in Italy for many black players, as we're seeing on almost a weekly basis. And I think to myself, if you're Romelu Lukaku, or if you're Chris Smalling, you probably have the choice to go to a lot of top European football clubs. And I'm not trying to say that there's no racism. There's racism everywhere. I get that.
But there's different degrees.
There's different degrees. Why would you choose to go to a league because... knowing full well there's a reputation that you're going to be racially abused, even by your own fans at some point. I never... Can anybody else square why?
Money. Money.
I think it's money, and also you don't see the longevity in you staying there. Like, you see it for a fixed period of time. Yeah. So you kind of just...
But surely
you
your mental health for Duma is more important than an extra 30 grand.
I can't even go to, like, some countries by myself. I'm just like, no, it's not for me. But I think... I can see how people might look at it. Well, all I'm doing is I'm training, so I'm at the ground with the players who I know I won't get anything from, and I'm in front of a crowd maybe a couple of days a week. I think if maybe I can just see maybe people breaking it down like that to themselves to go.
If you've got a normal job and you have to go to another country, I get it. But when you're a multi-millionaire, you have to pick a choice of.
But also, Drew, when we were young, our generation, Italian football was the one, right? Mm-hmm. You know. How many people do you play football outside and they had like their Juventus shirt or their Del Piero shirt, their Ronaldo shirt? I think some people just take the attitude, well, I want to go and do this and I will push through. And I look at Lukaku and I look at his personality and I think that's what he does. Mm-hmm. And I don't knock it for it. Sometimes people have to break those boundaries to make things better as well.
That was definitely my attitude as well. Like, I remember actually having a conversation with Patrice Evra just before I moved out to Turin. He obviously played for Juventus and he was like, "Any, don't do it."
Really?
He was like, "Don't do it." And I said, "Listen, like, your experience is different from my experience." And for me, I had the same mentality. Like, well, racism's everywhere. I'm not going to stop my life because of it. Mm-hmm. And I do think that needs to be the mentality of players. Like, don't let it win to the point where you're not going to go and play for a big club. However, and I think there's different degrees. I don't think any black player should go and play in Russia. I think Italy, there is now outrage when it happens, and so there will become a point where it happens less and less. But I think we also underestimate that players have become desensitized to this stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not okay. Mm-hmm. But Romelu Lukaku, and certainly me, like, I don't lose sleep over that stuff. Like, I can only speak for myself, but it's not something that you think, oh gosh, I can't function or I can't go out and play my best. For some players, it actually drives them on. Yeah. So the point I'm trying to make is that, like, when you have the opportunity to go to an Inter Milan, a Rome, a Juventus, you're not thinking of the racist, idiotic, uneducated people in the stands. You're thinking, how's this going to elevate my career? Mm-hmm. That comes with it. Mm-hmm. But I think players now know how to navigate it and deal with it and call it out whilst still getting on with their career. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like that was my mentality too. Like, you're not going to stop me going to Juventus because of one or two, not even one or two, but because of a culture of racism.
Yeah, question, and if you can't answer it, feel free to, but did your quote-unquote negative experience in the UK towards the end have any bearing on you moving to Italy, do you think?
Not really, because there was like a two-year gap where I was still in England. So
I guess a lot of us kind of heard about your later, but
not really, to be honest. I think that for me, like I said, it was very much a footballing decision. Like, you know, I came to the end of my time at Chelsea and I was like, okay, I need to do something different. I did feel at times that I lived in a bit of a fishbowl. Certainly walking around London, sometimes I get sort of labelled as that, oh, she's the girl that, you know, took on the FA. But that was always a positive experience. People were sort of applauding me for it. But sometimes that gets boring as well, because that's not all my life was about. So maybe, maybe it played into it, but it wasn't the reason I left the country. It was, not at all, actually.
I feel like a big part of, like, as to going back to what we're talking about, players who go abroad and kind of, quote-unquote, go to countries that they aren't accepted. I think a big part of it is also when you deal with racing, maybe to not that scale, but it's been a part of your life from a very early age, whether it's subtle or kind of conscious or unconscious, it becomes normalized. Yeah. You don't like, the only way I can compare it to myself is like, I'm visibly Muslim. So growing up, I think I had a lot of like Islamophobic experiences. But if I say it to people, they'll be like, oh my God, that's crazy. How did that happen? Mm. How did you go out? Bloody. But to me, it's kind of just like, nah, that's kind of, as long as you know, like, I'm healthy and living and able to get from A to B, that's cool. But I wouldn't think of anything outside it. So I feel like that's maybe how players look at it. It's like, as long as it doesn't directly kind of come out and causes a problem, it's kind of bearable, which isn't a nice way to see it. But I can see why people look at it like that.
We've been so used to an environment of silence where people daren't speak up. For any to break that mold will hopefully create a shift that will give others confidence to speak out if anything comes up like this ever again. That was from Anita Asante, who is currently playing for Chelsea.
I'll be down in King's Meadow on the weekend.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I thought was a lovely kind of quote. All right, let's move on from that now, because I want to talk to you about some other football things. You started playing at a very young age. There's so many young footballers, I'm thinking more in the Premier League now, this season in particular, across Arsenal, Chelsea, United, Foden at City. There's a lot of pressure now on youngsters to kind of deliver very, very early on. What advice would you give to a Foden or to a Saka at Arsenal or to a Mount at Chelsea in dealing with the pressure at a big club at a very, very young age?
Well, I think all of those players you mentioned need one thing consistently, and that's a manager that believes in them and gives them the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you don't have that, you're really at the helm of, you know, going on loan and trying to prove yourself, or waiting for your opportunity behind many expensive senior players. So I do think in modern football you need that break, because otherwise, you can train and do good in training all you like, but unless you're able to show it on the big stage, then you're not going to be able to show that. But I think, like, for the likes of Mason Mount, Tammy Abraham, some of these lads.
Great striker, Tammy Abraham.
Yeah, they did well on their loans. They did well on their loans in a very difficult Championship league.
It's
you're
tough.
Playing Tuesday, Saturday. So they were able to prove that, no, if you put me in, I'm ready. And that's what they're doing.
I always believed that Tammy was going to be.
Heard his quotes on Tammy Abraham?
Oh, okay.
He called him a bottom half of the Championship striker.
Okay, oh, wow. So, all right. So last, I had some opinions on Tammy Abraham, and he's kind of proving them wrong now. But I'm happy for him because he's doing the thing. He's banging the goals in, and he's proving that. Anyway,
he's gonna score against you.
He will. Foden's an example that I find really interesting as well, because I've got a theory that Pep is testing him. I think Pep is deliberately. I think he does rate him, and I think that he. Does intend to play him, but I think he is testing him to see how he reacts to being held back for so long, to see if he'll make up noise, to see if he'll lose concentration, to see if he'll lose focus. Do you feel that him getting his head down and just playing and training, learning, albeit at the cost of minimal minutes on the pitch, will serve him well in the long run? Or do you think Phil Foden needs to be playing now, getting first team football, and he's good enough to, if he doesn't get first team football soon, he'll miss that boat. He'll miss that sweet spot of.
No, I don't think he'll miss the boat, because I think Pep Guardiola has massively put a lot of faith in him, even in the games he's come on, and the games he started in the Champions League. Like, what? How old is Phil Foden?
I think he's 20 now.
What 20-year-old is being given that kind of backing from, you know, one of the best managers?
Maybe
in
19
the world.
Actually, yeah.
Like, literally, it's him. So Phil Foden, even if he doesn't play a lot in the next year, 2 years, whenever he's ready to step up, he'll either be ready for Man City or another club.
Mm.
And they'll always see him as the lad that Pep Guardiola gave a lot of backing to,
mm-hmm.
and actually proved that he could hold his own when he was given those opportunities. So sometimes it's not about starting all the time. It's about what you do when you play.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Phil Foden has massively shown that he's... You know, he's kind of worth the hype, and worth the level of trust that Pep Guardiola has given him. I do think, though, Pep Guardiola, like, gasses it a lot. Like, he sort of speak, you know, I think he made best a quote like, best footballer I've ever worked with. He's like, well, play him then, start him. You know, I just think sometimes it's a bit like, what are you trying to achieve with saying that?
This is why I think
that
maybe he's testing him. Because I'm like, I'm baffled as well. I'm thinking, why would you say that and not play him?
I don't know if it's a test. I just think it's just, you know, maybe it's a bit of guilt. You know, maybe it's like, oh, I wish I could only play 11 players. And like, I really want to play you, but actually, you've got Kevin De Bruyne in there. You've got David Silva. You've got Gundogan, who's played very well. So it's difficult. Who do you drop? Mm. But you know, he's just got to keep his head down and be confident with the fact that actually the manager is giving him as many opportunities as he can.
I want to get to your book in just a minute. Before that, you've got an older brother who was a professional footballer in the Premier League as well.
Mm.
Was it a blessing or a curse having an elder brother that made it pro?
Oh, it was never a curse. Definitely not a curse.
Did it make it harder for you?
God forbid, no. No.
Sorry, but curse was the wrong word there. Sorry.
No.
Well, did it make it harder? Sorry, I rephrased that question.
Yeah, no. I think it was an inspiration, really. You know, it's really helpful to have a brother that, you know, played at the highest level and is able to relate to me playing at the highest level in my game. Just, you know, and we used to have a lot of conversations, obviously about football, but all the stuff around football that people don't see. So, you know, dealing with a manager that doesn't say hi to you in the morning or like little things. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm like, oh, how do I deal with this? Or, you know, dealing with not playing or starting or having a good run of form or not scoring. Like, we'd have those conversations like, oh, I can't buy a goal at the moment. Like, what do I do? And he'd be like, right, okay, this is what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd always respect what he's saying because he's playing in the Premier League. So it was always really helpful to have that level of just being able to relate on that level was really big for me.
Cool. You have a book out.
Yes.
I'm seeing it everywhere, Annie. All my people. I'm seeing it everywhere. I can't.
They don't teach this.
Yes. I'm seeing it on all my friends and colleagues.
Oh, Twitter amazing. Feed,
Instafeed, they're really supporting it. Tell us a little bit about what the point of the book was. Because everyone that writes a book, I was thinking to myself, okay, what is the point of your book? Are you trying to get out? Are you trying to change the perception of you? Are you trying to get stories out there that are not out there?
Mm.
Are you trying to... What when you put together this book, what did you want to achieve with this book?
Well, I have to say that I didn't set out to write a book. I was offered the opportunity to write a book.
Okay.
And then it was okay, this is a big opportunity in a time in my life when, you know, I'm probably sort of heightened public figure, and there's a lot of sort of perceptions about me that aren't necessarily correct.
Mm-hmm.
or you know, there's lots of different views on me.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was about, okay, how do I do this to have maximum impact, be completely vulnerable, completely open and transparent, but also have a legacy that I can pass on to the next generation. And not even that's the next generation, just other women mm-hmm. that, you know, I can relate to. So they don't teach us the title I was very keen on because it was all about, okay, I can write about myself as a footballer, as a lawyer, as a, you know, somebody who went to uni and all these things, as a black woman, black Nigerian woman in England. But I know other people experience those things as well. And so it was about saying, okay, I've learned a lot of stuff in my life from when I was young to now that I can share with other people and open up the conversation so that we can kind of grow together.
Mm-hmm.
So the way the book's written, it's almost like a class, like there's like nine chapters called classes. And in each chapter, there's lessons that you can draw out of each chapter. And I really wanted those to be conversations that I could, like, once the book comes out, I could share with other people and we can kind of understand how to navigate life together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what fortunately it's become, you know, once, and the book kind of is written from obviously my perspective, but then the voice of the book then talks about you. So it kind of flips perspective all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the idea of it being a shared experience. So now, you know, I'm going into schools and, you know, I did an amazing session in partnership with Football Beyond Borders. And I went into a class of girls, I think it was like 20 girls who had read the book.
Mm.
And, you know, we talked about self-validation, we talked about confidence, dealing with adversity, education, parents, and they'd read the book and kind of were drawing out their experiences, and I learned as much as they did.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kind of grew together in that way. So that was very much the legacy that I wanted to create from the book, whilst also addressing a lot of sort of misconceptions about me, and just being very honest.
What do you think people think about you that don't know you?
I think that, you know, one of the things, racism in this day and age is very, it's a very sensitive topic, but it's also, it's never been talked about more. We're way more comfortable about talking about racism than we've ever been, mm-hmm. I think. And that's a gift and a curse, because one, we can deal with the problem in an open way if we're talking about it. But two, but the problem is that if you're somebody like me who, you know, a lot of my publicity was based around my case dealing with racism, people box you in that category and think that is your whole life. Mm-hmm. Your whole life is intended to fight racism. Mm-hmm. I'm privileged. You know, I'm a very privileged individual, and I don't take that for granted. You know, I've got to the top of my career in football. You know, I've been given a lot of privileges as a result. And so I don't want to kind of play into this victim label mm-hmm. that people sometimes put on me, mm-hmm. because, yes, it was a very, very difficult time in my life, but I came out of it triumphant, trying to move on mm-hmm. and shut that kind mm-hmm. of very difficult time of my life back. So sometimes I find that people really want to box you and put you in that category, forgetting everything else that you've done. So whether it's the media or whether it's other black people who just kind of pin all of their frustrations on you, not understanding that it's a balance, you know.
I'm, there's more to you.
There's more to me, but I'm also progressive-minded. Like, mm-hmm. I don't want to keep talking about mm-hmm. that situation. As much as I'm somebody that will always speak up about racism when I find it and see it, I don't, you know, you can deal with stuff yourself without having to have somebody else speak up for you sometimes. You know, it's difficult to explain.
I
really go against, like, categorization, because mm-hmm. I think we're all multi-dimensional people. One day you can be massively strong on a point, another day you might not want to speak, mm-hmm. another day you might feel sad, another day you might feel happy. Like,
mm-hmm. yeah.
we can't box
that's
who
him
we are.
And that's her.
Yeah,
and,
like, so I find that frustrating sometimes, but it's a reality of my life, I think.
I hear you. Fadumo, it's also awkward talking about someone that's right next to you, but as someone that now is quite heavily involved in the women's game, yeah. from a media point of view, how important are individuals and people like Annie, and not only having the body of work that they've done in women's yeah. football, but how they speak out and about the women's game and football generally?
No, I think it's really important. Like, especially coming into football, it was something that I was very conscious of. Like, it was just the norm to be in a room and be the only person of an ethnic minority or of a visibly, like, religious background. So in that sense, it was always kind of like, I always find that you have to filter yourself down, because you kind of just look at other people and you assume, okay, I don't want to be true to myself too much, because mm-hmm. I don't want to come across like AB. So there's a lot of thought that goes into things. So, but I read, and what I really like about your book, because I've read parts of it, is that is the thing that you can take different lessons from it and apply it to kind of look at your own life, in the sense that when you talk about having a Nigerian passport and then mm-hmm. playing for England and then realizing only that time they actually need a British passport, and I'm just like, the amount of time someone has called me up and said, yeah, you're British, and I'm just saying that, like, no, I'm not. Having, it's like that's yeah. the relatability, yeah, and it's yeah. like I could probably pick up books from other people, but it wouldn't have that fact in it. So I'm the biggest advocate, and always say, like, visibility is so important, because I feel like I didn't see people in this kind of position growing up, and I'm having to kind of create my own blueprint and navigate my way around it. But I hope that by just being present, it kind of gives someone else the idea to be like, oh, okay, then I can do it. And it's like, it's a case of, like, if they do it a little bit better, then so be it, because you want the bar to continue sure. to raise over and over again. But it's just like that, by being in that space, you're kind of doing enough already. And that's, like, how I see it.
And geez, you always kind of call me on the fact that I am always quite hard on expecting certain figures in the game to talk out more about certain issues. Mm. And your point kind of resonates, I suppose, with Annie's point, that I've got to stop expecting people to talk out about certain things because sometimes some people don't want to talk about those certain things all the time.
Yeah.
Because Sterling's probably a recent example of someone who I've made certain comments and things about, and you've kind of said previously what he said about maybe Sterling doesn't want to always talk out about racism just because he's done it once or twice.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to be the guy that talks out about racism.
It's a tough one, and it's always, and it kind of goes on to something I want to ask. It's a bit difficult, and again, if you wanna bat it away, feel free to. But
we'll get to the fun stuff in a minute. I promise. But,
but like that kind of, like when you have that situation, and then like there is settlement, and then there's kind of justice, and there's kind of like sometimes for there to be full justice, you got to blow everything up, right? And bring everything out. But then when the settlement is kind of like you take some money and then there's certain things that can never be released. How...
Everything was released.
Everything was released in your case.
Yeah, okay. So let me explain to you the settlement factor, because I would never have got a settlement if I wasn't going to take it all the way. Mm-hmm. So one doesn't come without the other. So I was willing to go all the way to court. Mm-hmm. On the matter, because I just felt like it wasn't dealt with in the right way. But fundamentally, the matter and the case started confidentially anyway. It was never meant to come out. Somebody leaked it. Okay. And that's because ultimately I'd spent 11 years playing for England. I wasn't trying to shatter the whole football association. I was just trying to deal with a certain matter that needed to be dealt with within the team. That didn't happen. It was dealt with poorly. Then my last option was to go to court. I was willing to go all the way, but ultimately, I think you have to balance out the effects of justice, not just on yourself, on everybody else, on your family. The FA did the same. So, you know, a settlement was very much based on what I lost in terms of my career. I knew I was never going to play for England again, and actually probably didn't want to at that time. And that was it. That was it. If you lose your job tomorrow based on your boss being racist towards you, I would expect you to be financially compensated.
Yeah,
I think people look at it in the completely wrong way, are uneducated about it, and they go, "Well, you took money and you shut up." And yeah, but you know everything about the case, so you can't know everything about the case if I kept my mouth shut. It was a financial settlement that was based on what I lost out in my career. That's it.
Yeah, I feel like it's just what you lost in future. Like you've lost, at that point, you've lost the ability to play for England, and you've probably lost a lot of commercial things that will probably come to a lot of players. So in that sense, I feel like that's how I think of it, and that's why I think. And I think it just sets a bar, and like I feel like everything should be dealt with in that kind of manner. And I think by I don't know how to explain it, but by not kind of having something like that, it kind of just makes it look like, oh, well, racism is going to be dealt with, but behind closed doors and in complete secrecy. When it shouldn't be dealt like that.
Yeah, because I'm just look. I mean, like, maybe I'm misinformed about your case, but you look generally like you like take Kaepernick for instance. When he got his settlement, we haven't heard from him since. You know what I mean? And I feel like
Should he not have taken a settlement?
I almost feel that, I mean, and it's up to him whether he does or not. I can't put that on.
Do you know
him,
how much he's lost as a result of the NFL keeping him out of the game?
You know.
But let me ask you. Let me ask you, because I think sometimes the expectation of celebrities is just is different from reality. Mm-hmm. If you lost your job tomorrow, I don't know what you do. If you lost your job tomorrow as a result of a huge injustice, as a result of your manager being racist towards you or treating you differently to the rest of your colleagues, and you were a valued member at your workplace, what would you do?
Yeah, I would definitely. Of course, I'd take them to court and try to get the money for it. But I feel
okay. So that's it.
In terms of,
are you saying that athletes shouldn't take the money and push the case all the way to get justice?
Push the case all the way.
But Kaepernick, from what I know, hasn't really said much in like the last 2-3 years, and he's got a settlement now, and he's got money from Nike. He's not like unwell off. Like, I think he could have pushed the case further and not taken a settlement. In that case, I'm not saying yours, but I'm saying
Kaepernick is one of the most well-known activists in the world. I don't watch NFL. I didn't know Colin Kaepernick until he came out and started kneeling. So I'm not sure what you mean by he should have taken it all the way. He took it as it was a movement. He took it as far as he possibly could.
But if you look at it, after he went, once the settlement came, no one, like, he there was a movement and there was, and he was the head of it. But then a lot of people who backed him actually said, well, we don't know what the movement is anymore.
But those people backing him, and this is my point.
But I feel like in that case, they were backing him and not what the actual situation
like those
was.
Those people backing him,
which
if you
is
injustice
talk,
in
America.
Yeah, if you want to talk about kneeling, you talk about it. Mm-hmm. Like, why are you waiting for Colin Kaepernick to do it? This is the problem, that when you become that voice, mm-hmm. everyone then expects you to take on all of their burdens and talk on their behalf. What if Kaepernick dropped down dead tomorrow? What, so the movement stops? Talk if you want to talk, and if you're passionate about that cause, you find your voice and talk.
No,
do you know what I mean?
You know, any honestly, like, I don't totally disagree with you. I think you've got a great point, but it does seem like sometimes, you know, I'm not saying you, and I'm not saying Colin, but at some point, someone will have to take it all the way, right? Because it does feel sometimes that when a settlement comes, it's like,
what does take it all the way mean?
Take it all the way means, like, to take it all the way to court. Even if you lose money, take it all the way to court, get the authorities charged, and then still be able to come out and talk about it after, because sometimes when the settlement comes, that can be the end of that conversation, and in particular that religious case.
I don't think
case.
It is the end of the conversation.
Okay, let's agree on that one, because then you've got to go in a second. Couple of quick ones I want to ask you, well, three ones. First of all, I'm going to Nigeria for Christmas.
I'm in Ghana.
Everyone's going to Ghana, and I'm in
Ghana. Yeah, Ghana's going to be popping.
The party's in Ghana, apparently. But in Lagos, I don't know exactly where I'm going, but is there somewhere you recommend you've got to go there, you've got to do that,
yes.
you've got to do this?
So my favourite restaurant is called Knock by Alara.
Okay.
It's like a fusion restaurant, Nigerian food, but they've done it in such quite a posh way, and they the way they bring out the food is amazing. And Knock by Lala is the one.
Cool.
Where else?
I've been warned about the traffic.
I'd say food, Knock by Lala.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, got to look out for that one. Yeah. The best goal you ever scored?
The best goal I ever scored was probably... you can find it on YouTube. I scored a goal against Holland. It was actually a friendly. And I dribbled probably about 6 players. And like curled it into the top corner.
Go on.
that was a nice goal as well, because at the time I wasn't really starting a lot and I wasn't really playing a lot, so it was kind of like,
take
yeah,
that, coach.
I'm still here.
My question is, who do you think's going to win the WSL this season?
Oof. Well, Chelsea just dropped points yesterday, and I was like,
can't believe it.
That's the worst thing. Like when they beat Man City. That was a big win.
Yeah.
But then there's no point if you're going to drop points. So, and then they've got a big game against Arsenal coming up January
13th. They've got a game in hand.
They need to win that game against Arsenal. So I don't know. I'm going to say Chelsea. I think Chelsea wants Sam Kerr comes.
Do you think they need Sam Kerr?
I think they need Sam Kerr. 100%.
Yes, okay, the other day confirmed it, but in general, I wasn't a supporter of Sam Kerr coming into
100%,
Chelsea.
100%, they need some. They need a player that's going to be very, very... I mean, Beth England has been pretty prolific, but she's still not world-class in the way Sam Kerr is world-class. I think Sam Kerr will
like
attract...
I feel like with the quality that Chelsea has, or like if you look at Beth England, Fran Kirby, Ramona, and I just feel like that's top-quality strikers they've all got there. And then bringing another one into the mix of that, I just one too many, maybe.
We've got to wrap this.
I was going to ask one more question. I was going to say,
can we please?
If you could be one player, and if you were not any, who would that player be?
Men or women?
Any.
Oof. If I could be any player, it would probably be Messi, man. Like, that's an easy one.
Yeah, Messi's
I mean, the guy is just... The guy is just... Yeah.
He's a freak.
He's a freak. He's a genius.
What makes you smile about football today?
What kind of question is that?
listen.
What makes me smile? I like where we're at now in terms of like women in the media. Like we can do way better, but just like I feel like it's becoming more normalized. Women speaking.
I had
about
so many questions about you when working at the not only the previous World Cup, but you were at the previous men's Euros.
Yeah,
was it the Euros for ITV? Is that correct? Got that right? Yes, and I love that. I love the fact that you were there with Patrice Evra and I don't know if it was Ian Wright or Roy Keane, whoever it was. And there was a whole hoo-ha about Evra made a comment or something and it blew up and it didn't go down too well.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I just like the fact that you were just giving, like, everybody else, or I'll say everybody else, but most of the other pundits, interesting, insightful, articulate analysis on the games. Do you know what I mean? And it felt,
yeah,
it
that's what
normal.
I was there to do. That's what I was there to do. And to your point, Vidim, sometimes taking up space is the most powerful thing. And I wasn't about to get distracted with Evra's comment.
And I could tell.
Know? I just thought, listen, I'm here to do a job and I'm just really here to prove that I can do it. And I, that's what I mean. Like, it's becoming more and more normalized. Mm-hmm. If you know your stuff, you know your stuff as a woman in the game. And I know a lot of men are still scratching their ears because they're not used to a high-pitched voice talking about football, but that's up to them.
Whatever. And
we ain't going to go anywhere.
Good. And the final question I ask all my guests, any on the shootout, is this. If there's one thing about football that you could change or improve, what would it be?
Right now, it would be just the levels of punishment when racism happens in the game. Like, for me, it's a no-brainer. That's what needs to happen. You know, dock points, kick teams out of competition. I don't know why we're still faffing around not doing it. You know, UEFA, FA, they need to just do it. And so when it happens, we all know what's going to happen. That for me is what needs to change.
Happy days. We're going to continue talking and laughing at Chelsea's defeat on the weekend.
Oh, jeez.
And also United being crap as well.
But thank you so much, guys.
Thank you very much for coming on this week's FFP shootout. Also, the book is out. Go get the book.
Yes, so you can get the book on Amazon. You know, I think there's still time to get it for Christmas if you want to buy it for friends and family. So you can get the book on Amazon. I think you can still get it a hard copy at Waterstones, a signed copy at Waterstones. For those abroad, you can get it on Book Depository. The audiobook is on Audible, All My Voice. It's all there.
And I didn't ask you, 2020, what does the future hold for any Luco? What's what can we look forward to next year? And can you tell us?
I was literally going to ask you, like,
I can't
which
tell you, man.
What is WSL TV playing for?
Announcements are pending. Announcements pending.
Okay.
We ain't got long to wait.
I was going to guess, but I feel like I'm a minute. Can I guess?
No. Don't do that.
If you guess, you're going to make me.
But trouble.
Listen,
so excited.
It's exciting. It's exciting. 2020 is exciting. And it's one of the reasons I came back home was because of of the opportunities lining up for next year in football. I can say that it's all in football. So watch this space.
Wicked. Go on. Thank you. Just come on the pod.
Thank you so much.
And all the best for the new year.
Thank you.
So thank you very much to Eni for coming on the pod this week. Really enjoyed that. Let's just pick up, guys, on a few more quick things. Before we do so, let's have a chat about Arsenal. In fact, let's do Arsenal and Chelsea in one. Arsenal 3-0 losers to City. Strong talk, start with UG, that Mikel Arteta will be, they're in talks. The Arsenal hierarchy are in talks with Mikel Arteta about taking the role as Arsenal boss. I knew that Arteta was going to get the job when Pep did an interview before the Arsenal game on Sunday. He was asked a question about whether he'd spoken to Mikel Arteta about his future and blah, blah, blah. And Pep's answer was just so lame. It was quite obvious that it was looking like he was going to leave. Can you see any logic of sense to make this a good move if indeed this is confirmed in the next 48 hours?
It's a good move for the Arsenal board. Because I think the Arsenal fans will kind of accept it.
They won't. Trust me, they won't.
It's the cheaper option. It's a safe pair of hands, but it's not a big name manager who's going to really kind of tear down walls or get mad if he doesn't get his. You know, he will feel privileged to be the Arsenal manager, and therefore I can't see him doing a Conte or something like that, for example, where he doesn't get the players he wants. So it's a good move for the Arsenal board, probably. Is it a good move for Arsenal overall? I doubt it. I mean, he's worked with Pep, so you'd like to think some of some of the Pep magic might have rubbed off on him. But at the same time, you get that all the time where the assistant comes and they just don't live up to the billing. So I think it will probably keep Arsenal about where they are, which then would be a bad appointment.
Fadumo, can you put any argument forward to suggest that it could be a good appointment?
Yeah, and also I think is a questionable appointment, but at the same time, being in the market that we are for managers, I don't really think they had much of a better choice. That's kind of what happens if you sack your managers early on.
You've got to
have the scraps. But I reckon they could have just hold tight for a bit to the end of the season and had like a better option. But
that's the thing. You've got Ancelotti looks like he's going to Everton. You've got pay the money for Pochettino. What can it be? 12, 15 million? You spend that on a player. Pay the money and get him in.
I don't personally think Ancelotti would have been a good appointment because I think Ancelotti's not a builder of clubs.
He's not.
Ancelotti's a guy you get in when you're Spurs. But when you're a top-ish team that's flirted with success, you need the guy to come in and just cross that line.
But
rebuilding kind of manager.
But what is Arteta?
Well, at least the one reason why I'm not angry about it is because it's the unknown. So it could go really, really badly. Or you might, you could look back in 2 years and be like, remember when people were laughing at Arsenal putting Arteta? Now they're a top four team again. I totally accept it's a massive gamble. It's a huge gamble. I'm not trying to hide from that fact. But I just think Arsenal, I've said before, are on the floor. Arsenal are broken. And when you're on the floor, I just think, like, you're not going to get Klopp and you're not going to get Pep Guardiola. So everyone else is pretty much a risk, just levels of risks. So you might as well go for the guy that hasn't got a bad track record, even though he's not got a good one either. Dude, he's a clean slate. Do you know what I mean? That's the way I'm kind of squaring it. Am I clutching for hope there?
Yeah, I think you're clutching.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool. Let's move on. We won't do City because it's just long. But the title race is over now, right? We all agree the title race is done.
Yeah.
Okay,
go on. Tell us who's going to... Because
You were going to say Leicester, maybe Chelsea.
After this weekend's defeat, it's looking a bit tight for Chelsea. I can't...
What?
I said tight.
No. Chelsea were never in the race.
It's not looking good for anyone, to be fair. Liverpool.
It's a simple question. No offense, is the title race done?
No, not yet.
So you think there's another team apart from Liverpool that could lift the Premier League title this season?
I think the slim chance that Man City have is now Liverpool's schedule and going away and building enough points.
Isn't it 14 points at the moment?
Just get it down to 5 or whatever. Get it down to 5. It's looking wrapped up.
It's looking wrapped up.
We're not even in 2020. I can't sit here and say the league is over, man. What's the point? You might as well go home.
Exactly. Give them the trophy now. That's it.
It's over. I get your sentiment, but let's look at the realism. Liverpool are not going to lose 5 games. They're just not. They're just not going to lose 5 games, G. And you know it.
We got to play them at Anfield.
I thought the title race was over a month ago, but if there was any team that had a chance for Duma, it was Leicester.
Yeah.
But to do so, they had to go into that game on Boxing Day, I believe, against Liverpool, winning all their games, dropping points on the weekend. They killed themselves.
Yeah.
They're done. So you know it's done, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
And I wasn't supporter of Leicester. I would rather have taken Leicester winning the league any day. I thought that would have been the greatest moment, besides Leicester having already won it.
It would have been good. If Liverpool had bottled it and Leicester won the league,
honestly,
been...
And then I think Klopp would have called it a day, because I don't think
he can pop. Just allow it loud.
Yeah, exactly. But I think them dropping points just cost them right now, and we should all call it a day.
I agree. On Chelsea, G, you didn't lose on the weekend. To Bournemouth, who have been in awful form. I don't know how you lost to Bournemouth. Was you there?
No, I wasn't there. I was organising my lady's birthday party.
You were in better company than you would have been at Stamford Bridge. what went wrong?
I was watching the game. I think in a similar way to like Sarri Ball last season, I think teams have actually started to work out Frankie Ball. So if you,
Frankie Ball.
So if you play quite,
he's been a manager 2 minutes. He hasn't got a ball.
He's got us off to a playoff final, and that's manager. It's got a ball now. But yeah, it's. I think people have worked out if you defend quite deep against us, it can be, you know, can make it difficult. I think the fixture schedule pile up, and some certain players just fall in off form. So it's funny because I talked up Hudson-Odoi after the game against Newcastle. He hasn't had another good game since. Mm. He's actually been really bad.
Do you think he needs a loan spell? Because I feel like he needs to just maybe a good season in the Championship.
He's linked to Rochdale.
He's on a hundred grand. He's on a hundred grand. He can't.
Okay, maybe not.
Very expensive.
I feel like that built
a lot of your players.
There is a point to that. He hasn't had a full season of football anywhere, like of professional men's football. So to a certain extent, you can expect or understand why he would struggle. But yeah, every time he comes on, he makes wrong decisions. He's losing the ball. He's not effective. And so you've got...
He's De Bruyne-esque, you said. Oh, Jesus.
I know. That's one of those ones for the highlight reel here this season.
Don't worry. I've flipped it.
So yeah, so Pulisic and Willian are playing every week and playing Champions League Tuesday. And Willian is, you know, wrong side of, you know, 30. And it's just not, we're not looking effective, and we're really struggling at home where teams just don't come and show ambition against us because they don't need to, because they might get one good chance and then, you know, Kepa might, you know, doesn't reach out to the corner and then we've conceded. So, I think we've got Tottenham next week. There's no better game to galvanise us because I'm saying on live on air, recorded. We don't lose to Tottenham, so
we're coming back to this.
Is that a second clip that I got to put together for the show reel at the end of the season?
But this Christmas period will be really tough for Frank. I think the game's coming thick and fast, and also and we was talking it off air, like Frank has got to take some responsibility as well, like. His lineups, generally speaking, are what I would tend to go with. But his substitutions on the weekend were really bad, and they have been a few times. And his game management is a big part of why we're... And that's a mental thing. And you're coaching people to get that. And if he's not coaching, then you have to ask the question.
Yeah, I think we're just saying this. Is it the legend Lampard factor that's kind of giving him this favourable treatment that you're also seeing at other clubs such as United, before you throw that at me?
Well, that's the thing.
Do you think that's part of what's kind of becoming excusable and why you're not seeing as a outraged fans?
Well, you don't want it. You don't. I mean, I said about Frankie Ball and, you know, giving that. You don't want him to become Frankie at the wheel. You know what I mean?
I'm not gonna lie. I kind of do.
And here's the thing: is like, I think he's a bad Christmas away from becoming Frankie at the wheel. You know what I mean? And if you look, we've got Arsenal and we've got Tottenham coming up, and the big schedule. Like, but. I've still got faith in him. I think he could turn it around. And you know what? Either way, I think sometimes it's easy to forget that he was put into a difficult situation. But as I said, and I say it week in, week out on the pod, he should at least make top four. If he hasn't, he's underachieved.
Fair enough. I wanted to have a discussion with you guys about ex-players going back to clubs. There seems to be this massive trend with managers at the moment, managing clubs that they're either closely affiliated with or used to play for or manage. So we're seeing possibly Arsenal and Arteta, Ferguson, Everton. Obviously, we know about Ole United, Frank Chelsea, Wilder, Sheffield United, the guy at Aston Villa. What's his name? Him, Aston Villa. And there's a couple others as well. But we're running out of time, so we'll do that show in the new year, guys. I've recorded it on the final show of the year. That'll be out next week. So, guys, listen up for that. That's another FFP shootout with, I won't tell you who the player was, but that was a really, really good interview we did as well. That'll be out next week. So I might as well say my Merry Christmases and Happy New Years now. Just briefly, guys, what are you doing for Christmas? What are your plans?
I'm just chilling at home, really.
Chilling at home?
Yeah, family.
Yeah, family thing. I would say at home, but it's going to be... different houses. Yeah, looking forward to it, man. Definitely.
Well, I'm out doing both for you because I'm going on holiday, as I mentioned. So
thanks for that, Jordan.
I'll be topping up my tan and, you know, eating some. I don't like jollof rice, so I'm going to try and swerve the jollof rice thing. But
get the fried rice, man.
Maybe a different kind of rice. Yeah. So but either way, I'll be living my best life. Have a very good Christmas, you guys, and be safe over the new year. Same to all you guys out there as well. Check us out. We'll be back middle of January because I won't be here, and the last person that covered me on this pod didn't.
Anyway,
why are you naming names for? I didn't name any names.
For doing my best.
I know now.
So we'll be back in the new year.
Why not let Fadooma do it?
Fadooma, you could do it. You want to do it?
Yeah, go on then.
Christmas Day, I think, is a Monday. So no, you couldn't do that one then. Let's talk about it off air.
Yep, okay.
But either way, I'll be back then. If there's a pod to come back to, because we might smash it.
I'll take it over.
I might not be wanted anymore. Have a great Christmas and a great new year. Check us out across all the socials and, of course, subscribe to us on iTunes and Spotify as well. Until next week, peace.